It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. In an attitude of prayer, we pray to the angels of our better nature and the still small voice that can speak to us when we feel safe enough to listen. Help us to love ourselves and to love people and causes outside of ourselves, that we may be enlarged to include them. Help us remember that we are never as alone or as powerless as we think. Help us remember that we can, if we will, invest ourselves in relationships, institutions, and causes that transcend and expand us. Help us guard our hearts against those relationships and activities that diminish us and weaken our life force. And help us give our hearts to those relationships and institutions that might, with our help, expand our souls and our worlds. We know that every day both life and death are set before us. Let us have the faith and courage to choose those involvements that can lead us toward life more abundant. And help us find the will to serve those life-giving involvements with our heart, our mind, and our spirit. We ask that we may see more clearly in these matters, and that we have the will to hold to those relationships that demand and cherish the very best in us. Just that. Just those. Amen. Years ago in Germany, we recently discovered, our ancestors created wooden spears about 6 feet long that were clearly used as hunting weapons. They were found among stone tools and animal bones. And just last month, chimpanzees were observed, for the first time I know of, making spears and using them to kill bush babies for food in the wild. So in the art of hunting with weapons that we made, we have now discovered we have a lot in common with chimpanzees. But without going to the drama of hunting with weapons, we share even more similarities with chimpanzees when it comes to the way we do politics. Franz De Waal, an ethologist who studied chimps for over 35 years, chimps, bonobos, rhesus monkeys, capuchin monkeys, and others, wrote a book on this in 1982, 25 years ago, still in print in whatever edition it's in, a book called Chimpanzee Politics that's become a classic in its field. It's based on thousands of hours of observations of the chimpanzee colony at the Arnhem Zoo in the Netherlands, where he first began studying one of our two closest relatives. The philosopher Thomas Hobbes described chimpanzee politics over 350 years ago as a general inclination of all, a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceases only in death. He was actually speaking of human politics, but his words describe male chimpanzee politics perfectly. When De Waal wrote his book, he was accused of anthropomorphizing chimpanzees, of watching their neutral behavior and projecting human motives and emotions onto them. But he said it actually worked in reverse. He didn't really care about human politics. But once he learned how chimpanzees did it, he could never look at human politics the same again. That's exactly the effect the book had on me. I think it's one of the most transformative books I've read and has fundamentally changed my expectations of human politics. That's not all good, but I think it's all true and sober, as you may see. Chimpanzee politics is all about getting and keeping power by the few over the many by any means necessary. Alpha males form alliances with influential males and females. In our species, that would mean powerful and rich. In chimpanzees, it's influential. Or subordinate males form coalitions to overthrow the alpha males and then consolidate their power by making alliances with influential females. The females have to be part of an alliance for the power to stay stable. Males seldom maintain their alpha rank for more than a few years. Then there's another round of opportunistic alliances and vicious fighting to crown a new leader, or as we call them, elections. The two mottos of chimpanzee politics are one good turn deserves another, and an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Chimpanzees remember forever, and they carry grudges. And the male political alliances are not personal, but functional. They're not alliances with friends. They're alliances with those who can, at the moment, be useful. Yesterday's enemy may be today's ally, and we may attack today's friend tomorrow morning. Adult male chimps live in a hierarchical world with replaceable coalition partners, they're all expendable, and a single permanent goal, power. DeWall describes them as the honest politicians we all yearn for. Adult females, in contrast, in the chimp colonies, live in a horizontal world of social connections, where power and influence are bestowed by others more on the basis of the female's character, not her physical strength. We know from psychological experiments with human subjects that in Western cultures, men and women show many similar differences. DeWall cited one colorful example of this, a little-known politician, little-known to most of us, Tancredo Neves, the briefly elected president of Brazil 22 years ago, who summed up the male attitude just beautifully when he said, "I have never made a friend from whom I could not separate, and I have never made an enemy that I could not approach." Neves had been a powerful critic of government for a long time, and just a few days after he was elected, he mysteriously died. So maybe his alliances weren't the most powerful alliances at the moment. Now, if presidential candidates take a sudden interest in women, listen to their problems, and hug their children, there are parallels in chimpanzee males who groom females and play gently with infants, especially during periods of power struggle. And yet, in chimps, as in humans, strength is weakness. This is one of the Achilles' heels of the whole enterprise. Because once an alpha presence has become established, it automatically generates alliances among weaker males to see if they can topple the alpha. Only very shrewd chimpanzees can maintain power in the face of younger and stronger males. Now, to see how chimpanzee politics works, and to see how much it feels like human politics, let's look at the story of three successive political revolutions in one chimp colony. This was in the Arnhem Zoo in the Netherlands, and it involved four males. You don't have to remember their names, and I don't have photos, though I've seen photos of them. Four males named Jeroen, who's certainly the heavy and the dominant, a male named Loot, and then Nikki and Dandy. Your own Nikki had before he came to the zoo, before he was given to the zoo when he got a few years old, Nikki had been skating with Holiday on Ice. That's what they do with very young chimps before they get strong enough to be dangerous. Yaron was a shrewd older chimpanzee and had ruled the group for some years when a younger and stronger male named Loot challenged him for power. And after humiliating him in two violent fights, dethroned him. I'll come back to what the loss of power did to Yaron. It's a story in its own right. But Loot, who Franz de Waal described as probably the most gorgeous, perfect example of a male monkey he'd ever seen, as he described Yaron as the shrewdest politician he'd ever seen, Loot was alpha male for only 10 weeks. Wily old Yaron formed an alliance with a strong new young male named Nikki during those 10 weeks. And one night, when the chimps were put into their night pens, their separate male and female pens for the night, Yaron and Nikki attacked Loot and killed him. De Waal says he could never again look at old Yaron without seeing a murderer. The following day, this is really an important scene because it has meanings at two levels and they contradict each other. We'll take one level now and come back to it later. The following day, they released Nikki and Yaron into the group. Immediately, a dominant female attacked Nikki fiercely, chasing him up a tree. She kept him there for 10 minutes by screaming and charging each time he tried to come down. Not surprisingly, she had always been Loot's main ally among the females, and she must have watched the murder from her pen, which offered a good view of the goings-on in the male pen. But a few hours after her solitary outburst, all the other chimps gathered around the killers, groomed them, and accepted them as the new leaders. And the very next day, a new triangle emerged. Another young male named Dandy began making overtures to wily old Yaron, grooming him and begging to form an alliance with him against Nikki. When Yaron and the new young male, Dandy, finally got enough power to confront Nikki, Nikki ran out into the water-filled moat and drowned. Apes can't swim. And another revolution had taken place. Yesterday's allies are today's enemies and vice versa, when it suits the pursuit of power. And that process will not end because it is the plot of chimpanzee politics. Not only does the process of gaining political power among chimps sound and feel familiar, but so do the effects of losing power once a male is dethroned. So I want to go back to what losing power did to old Yaron when Nikki finally dethroned him. The first time that Loot gained the upper hand, which marked the end of Yaron's ancient regime, he'd ruled the group for several years, Yaron reacted in completely uncharacteristic ways, surprising all the scientists who had studied him for years. Normally a very dignified character, powerful, quiet, wily, but dignified, Yaron became unrecognizable. In the midst of a confrontation, he would drop out of a tree like a rotten apple, as De Waal says, writhing on the ground and screaming pitifully, and waiting to be comforted by the rest of the group. He acted much like a juvenile ape being weaned by his mother. And like a juvenile, this is how wily Yaron is, like a juvenile who during tantrums keeps an eye on mom for signs of softening, Yaron always noted who approached him. If the group around him was big, or if it included the alpha female, then he would gain instant courage And with his new supporters in tow, he would renew the confrontation with his rival. So his tantrums were another example of his very shrewd manipulation. The parallels with infantile attachment in our own species are kind of fascinating, reminding us of expressions like clinging to power and being weaned from power. Knocking a male chimpanzee off his pedestal gets the same reaction as yanking the security blanket away from a baby. Now, when even those tactics didn't work and Yaron finally lost his top spot, he would often sit staring into the distance, an empty expression on his face. He was oblivious to the social activity around him, and he refused food for weeks. They thought he was sick, but their veterinarian found nothing wrong with him. Yaron seemed a mere ghost of the impressive big shot that he had been. When power was lost, his lights went out. This sounds so familiar. It's worth a couple animal stories from our species. Professor DeWall mentioned two cases, one involving a professor he had known. This was a senior professor, a colleague of DeWall's on the university faculty, a professor with great prestige and ego. He ran the department but had failed to notice a budding conspiracy. Some young faculty members disagreed with him on a politically sensitive issue. Quietly, they formed alliances and successfully rallied a vote against him at a faculty meeting. The professor was blissfully unaware of this political coup, partly because up until then, nobody had ever had the guts to go head-to-head with him. Support for the alternative proposal had been cultivated behind his back by some of his own protégés, allies. Following the fatal vote, which must have come out of the blue, giving his expression of disbelief, all color drained from the professor's face. Looking 10 years older, he had the same empty, ghost-like appearance Yaron had after he lost his top spot. For the professor, this was about much more than the issue at hand. It was about who ran the department. In the weeks and months following the meeting, his entire demeanor changed as he strode the halls. Instead of saying, "I am in charge," his body language now said, "Leave me alone." Another example of the behavior of a fallen alpha male involves someone much more famous. Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein's book, The Final Days, describes President Richard Nixon's breakdown after it became obvious that he would have to resign. Between sobs, Nixon was plaintive. How had a simple burglary done all this? Nixon got down on his knees. He leaned over and struck his fist on the carpet, crying, "What have I done? What has happened?" Henry Kissinger, his Secretary of State, reportedly comforted the dethroned leader like a child. He consoled him, literally holding Nixon in his arms, reciting all of his great accomplishments over and over until the president finally calmed down. This is chimpanzee politics from start to finish. Staying on top is a balancing act between forcefully asserting dominance, keeping influential supporters happy, and avoiding mass revolt. If this sounds familiar, it's because human politics, according to DeWall, works exactly the same. Power, as Henry Kissinger once said, is an aphrodisiac, but it's more than that. This isn't about Clinton. Power is also hypnotic and charismatic, and it draws subordinate males and females compliantly behind the powerful leader. This is a really dark side to both chimpanzee and human politics. When the chimpanzee, think about this again, we're revisiting this story. When the chimpanzee leader was murdered, there was a brief outrage against the murderer. But within hours, the group gathered around the murderers, now the new leaders, and began grooming them. They accepted the violence, got over their anger, and helped the new leaders provide stability. The king is dead. Long live the king. The two males sought power over fairness or justice. The rest sought stability and peace over fairness and justice. There are so many instances of this in our own history. It'll resonate with some of you in personal relationships or the silence in families surrounding the sexual abuse of children. But we do it as a society too. Think of the American public's acceptance of what looked like two stolen presidential elections and the dishonest and illegal invasion of Iraq and probably soon Iran, with the tens or hundreds of thousands of deaths these illegal actions have caused. This compliant trait of ours is what gives savvy rulers confidence that we can easily be tricked and trained. We support the powerful, no matter how they got their power, if we think they can bring us stability and peace. And so we say, don't make waves, go along to get along. Or in a much more stringent Japanese saying, the nail that sticks out gets hammered. Just this week, for instance, I read an essay by a social critic named Sheila Samples. I don't know who she is. I don't know anything about her. The essay is called Lost in the Lust of Werewolves, so she has an agenda. She reminded me of the outburst from that chimpanzee female who responded to the murder. See how this two-paragraphed excerpt strikes you. I wonder why so many denizens of this Christian nation seem unable or unwilling to wrap their minds around the reality that Iraqi people are human beings just as they themselves are, not rabid dogs to be hunted down and slaughtered. They don't want to know what it's like for families to cower in terror as their doors are kicked in, mothers and daughters raped, fathers and sons dragged off, never to be seen again. They don't want to know about prisoners being humiliated and tortured, secretly rendered to countries for more torture, held captive for endless years without charges, without hope, without life. They don't want to know about Iraq's rich culture, its secular society, its formidable institutions of learning, its rights for women. All of this, along with Iraq's long-suffering people, were made invisible, the better to smash the country as if it were only a den of thieves and murderers. It's a poignant outrage. But as almost always, after a few such outbursts, we go along. By now, you probably understand why Newt Gingrich put the book Chimpanzee Politics on the recommended reading list for all freshman congressional representatives in 1994. The message is, if you're going to play politics at this level, you need to know how it works. Study the chimps. You may have heard enough about chimpanzees for one day, so I have a story about ravens that I've wanted to share with you for 2 months, and this is the first time it actually fit in really well. Ravens are like very big crows, 4 to 5 pounds, and they seem to be regarded as the smartest of all birds, at least by raven lovers. They're carnivores, and they have hunted with wolves for hundreds of thousands of years, as well as with other large predators. They've been the subject of myths throughout human history, sometimes pictured with wolves. You can find this in a lot of Native American iconography, and sometimes just exalted by themselves as wise and mystical birds. I read a book called Mind of the Raven, not one I would have picked, except it was recommended by 3 or 4 other authors I was reading. And it's by perhaps the world's leading authority on ravens, a professor of ethology from Vermont named Bernd Heinrich. He has loved ravens for over a quarter of a century, And he has a half-acre aviary in Maine where he's even raised ravens. He studied them for decades, and he's traveled the world to watch these amazing birds. He knows their flights, their calls, their actions, almost everything about them, it seems. But even he was surprised by some of the stories he heard about ravens. One was a news story about a woman near Boulder, Colorado. She was working out in the woods behind her cabin when she was annoyed by a raven making so much noise it was irritating, cackling like crazy and diving low over her head. She'd never heard a raven make this much noise, and she wondered if it was trying to communicate with her. When it passed over her head again and then flew up, she looked up. That's when she saw the cougar about 20 feet away, crouching and ready to pounce. This woman was under 5 feet tall and weighed 98 pounds, so she was a good target. She called her 300-pound husband, who chased the cougar away. My hunch is this is more about weight than it is about gender. In the newspaper, she said, "The lion moved his head just a little bit as the raven flew over it. That's when I saw him. I never would have seen him otherwise. He was going to jump me. That raven saved my life." The event was described as a miracle in the news, and would feel that way if it happened to us, I suspect. Then up in Alaska, a man who had killed a deer came face to face with a bear who wanted to claim the meat too. Wisely, he backed away, said, "Okay, your deer." And he backed away as the bear went out of sight, apparently near the deer, though he didn't know. He said, "Ravens were following me and squealing. I thought they were guiding me and telling me that the bear was still after me." Pretty impressive and heartwarming stories. But the raven expert said, no, that's not what was really going on. The ravens were making noise to identify the location of prey. The ravens were hunting with the cougar and the bear, and the only thing they were trying to save the humans for was dinner. Those two people's reactions to their ravens, like most of our reactions to that story, are telling. We tend to assume that the ravens naturally were there for us. We make a Disney movie right inside our head. It's like we love Bambi, but we don't think about the wolf that's going to kill Bambi for food. And we don't want to think that the ravens may instead be there to serve their fellow hunters, hoping to make a meal of us. We're not special to ravens. When they're hungry, we're meat. Like chimpanzees, we react to politics this way too. We assume those in power are going to use the power to serve us, to serve our best interests. We don't like to think, and so seldom do think, of the fact that they may instead have formed alliances with the influential people who got them in power and that they're hunting with them. A hunt in which we can be the victims. When political lobbyists buy politicians in order to get them to remove restrictions on what corporations can do in pursuit of profit, for instance, you think of the Merck story that was just in the news a couple of weeks ago, and the payment of $5,000 each to politicians with the promise of more right here in Austin, that sort of thing, or the fact that Merck was doing that in 20 states. The bills that they then pass are always given a spin as though they're somehow for the benefit of we the people. But when the bills they buy also do things like removing bankruptcy protection from workers, removing the ability to sue pharmaceutical companies over faulty vaccines, transfer hundreds of billions of dollars from social services and health care to tax cuts for the rich and huge defense contracts, Then we're out in the wilderness with the cougars, the bears, and the ravens. And if we don't watch it, we'll be dinner. No, it doesn't always happen that way. Yes, there are certainly many people elected to power who try to serve the interests of regular, old, powerless, unwealthy, uninfluential, unuseful people like us. But just see how unappealing that sounds if you have the option of hunting with the cougars or the bears. The temptation is always there and can be very strong to support those whose money and influence got them into office in the first place. That's what alliances are about. That's what a quid pro quo works like, to honor the reciprocal nature of the political deals that brought them into power. If we're not rich or influential enough to seek out as allies in the hunt for power, we may be just meat. Any hungry raven or power-hungry chimpanzee would understand this immediately. We're hardwired to conform, to follow others, to defer to authority, even illegal authority, to be emotionally stressed when we don't follow others. But there's more to us than that. It's a story about our other closest relatives, the bonobos, and about girl power, and about the role that social expectations play in chimps and bonobos and us, but not in most monkeys. It's a story about some new and exciting findings of neuroscience in the studies of animals and humans on how thinking, this sounds spooky, on how thinking can change the structure of the brain. Most of all, it's about those better angels of our nature, how we can hear them, and how together we can transform our lives, our relationships, and our world. And it's a story we'll tell next week in the final installment of these animal stories. See you in church.